You are good to go, Dina.
Excellent. Before I start, welcome everyone. I'm going to introduce our speaker and the series in just a moment. If you could please take a minute just to mute your phones or mute your computers. Please mute their phones or their computers, and we encourage you to unmute and be very participatory. Carly, can you mute anyone who is not at this moment?
Yep.
Are we good? Okay. Here we go. Welcome everyone to the fifth season of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion's Continuing Learning Series Alumni Learn. This is, as always, a special project of our president, Rabbi Aaron Pankin. I am Dina Stein, Alumni Engagement Coordinator and Director of Alumni Learn. During this session and throughout the year, you can always reach alumni engagement at alumni@huc.edu. I'll share with you a few technical details about today's session in just a moment. We at HUCJIR are excited to bring you the latest in research and learning from our faculty. This year, we are pleased to offer online opportunities for learning focused on Israel, Parashat HaShavua, latest thinking in our faculty's research fields, mentoring the future, best practices for fostering future Jewish leadership, and mini courses taught by well-known faculty. A full list of session speakers and times can be found on the Alumni Learn site, huc.edu/alumni-learn. Today, we are honored to present a session from our Parashat HaShavua series with Rabbi David Sperling. I will introduce him momentarily, but before I do that, I'd like to say a few words about today's session. We are using the Zoom platform today, which means that we encourage you to please share your video if you are online. And while we ask you to mute when you're not speaking, we do encourage you to please unmute frequently so that you can speak, ask questions, or help read parts of the parasha. Towards the end of, and if you are on the phone, then it's the same thing with the muting. Please mute yourself when you are not speaking, but we do encourage you to please speak up, ask questions, create dialogue, and please do help us with reading. We are going to be sending a link with an evaluation towards the end of this week. Please do fill out the evaluation so that we can have a better understanding of your interests and needs as we work to plan the next semester. So if you have any technical difficulties with today's session, please contact our support team, which I believe is HUC faculty. If you are online, then you should be able to send them a direct chat. So now I'm going to introduce Dr. David Sperling, who serves as the professor of Bible and holds the Rabbi Julian Morgenstern Chair in Bible at the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion on the New York campus. Among his scholarly interests are the religion of ancient Israel, the history of modern Jewish biblical scholarship and comparative Semitic languages. Dr. Sperling earned his BA at Brooklyn College, was ordained at the Jewish Theological Seminary, and holds a PhD in ancient Semitic language from Columbia University. He is a member of the Central Conference of American Rabbis. Before coming to HUCJIR, Dr. Sperling taught at SUNY Stony Brook and then at Barnard College. He has served as visiting professor at New York University, Syracuse University, the College of William and Mary, and the Jewish Theological Seminary. With that, I am now pleased to turn this over to Dr. Sperling.
Hi, everybody. And speaking of CCAR, maybe I'll see some of you there in person because my wife and I will be going there. I'm going as the rabbinic spouse, but I will be giving one session, one study session there. In any event, so today we're going to look at Ki Tisa, which is a really loaded chapter. And I'll pick out some of the things that I wanted to concentrate on. And if you have things, if we have enough time, and you have something you want to raise that I haven't dealt with, please feel free. Also, I would like you to aid me in saving my voice by reading some stuff, and then I'll go over it. So who would like to start me off with the very beginning there? Of Ki Tisa. Harry? No? So whom can I get to read? Can you all hear me? But you don't like to read. Okay, so I'll read and then I'll comment. And please feel free to jump in at any time with questions. Sometimes I speak too quickly. Sometimes I assume something that might be familiar to me, but you might not have seen, which is often likely enough. So it starts off where it says God speaks to Moses and says, "Ki tisa et rosh bnei Yisrael l'kudehem v'natnu ish kofer nafsho l'adonai bivkodotam v'lo yiyeh v'hem negef bivkodotam." So it says, now what's interesting here, uses the expression "ki tisa et rosh," nasa rosh, literally to lift up the head. It has several meanings in the Bible, but the one that's here is just simply counting. In fact, we talk about counting heads, and counting heads is useful because as opposed to other bodily parts, most people have only one head. So Moses here, God speaks to Moses, and notice it's not a command to perform a census, but it kind of assumes that God has commanded Moses, because what it says here, when you take a census, et cetera, et cetera. So the assumption is that Moses is supposed to take a census. And there are different attitudes towards census in the Bible, and we'll look at a couple of them. Okay. So what it says here in the same verse of chapter 30, verse 2, when you do it, let everybody pay a ransom for himself. Kofer nafsho. L'Adonai, bivkodotam, v'lo yiyeh b'hem negef bivkodotam. So it says everybody has to give a ransom for his life on being enrolled so that no plague may come again upon them through their being enrolled. Now, when it says so that no plague may come upon them, what's the implication? That if they don't pay the money, right? If they don't pay the money, then they will be subject to a plague. Now, that's an interesting, so a question to this, a question here arises about the whole notion of taking a census. We will see there, in other places in the Bible, there's actual opposition to taking a census. Now, why might there be opposition to taking a census? I know the United States Census Bureau has a lot of people who evade the census. Why would they do that?
Because it's a draft.
The draft, right, conscription. Absolutely. What's another one?
Paying taxes.
Taxes, conscription and taxation. Invasion of privacy. And there's even a more irrational fear of what they call the evil eye. I noted here what Rashi says, Shehaminyan sholepo ein hara, that when you take account, when you take counts, the evil eye can have dominion, shilton, over you. The notion that's it's an irrational notion, but the fact is, if people see you have too much, they know too much about you, they may be envious. And that can kill you. The fact is, in the Talmud, I didn't write down the citation, but I'll find it by next time. In Brachot, it says that out of any 100 people, 99 die from the Ein Hara, literally the eye of evil, or in Yiddish, the Ein Hora, which is a term my mother used to use a lot. She'd always say something, you saw something good, she'd say, Kein Ein Hora. I'm glad that you have this beautiful baby, but I don't want to give you the evil eye. So it's irrational. But let me tell you how far back it goes. It goes back to our earliest written records. See, people started writing in in Iraq, in a place called Sumer in southern Iraq. And they start writing around 3100 BC, okay? By about 500 years after that, meaning around 2500 BC, we already have incantations that are meant to protect you from the evil eye. So it's a very old concept. When you count, the evil eye may you show what you have, or somebody counts you. And I'm sure you know that to this very day, in certain Orthodox circles, if they want to see that it's a minion, you don't count, right? What do you do?
Right? Not one, not two, not three.
that's one. Yes, one that I myself have seen. Not one. And I've heard it in Yiddish. Nicht eins, nicht zwei, nicht drei. And what's the other one?
A verse of numbers.
A verse. Oh, or it doesn't have to be, it just has to have 10 words in it. The one that I saw most often was Hoshiat Amecha Uvarech et Nachlatecha or Ein V'Nasem Ad Olam. Actually, any verse that has 10 words in it will be used. So it's a kind of it's a very old this fear of the evil eye is a very old one. So that's part of it. But of course, the real opposition is census, taxation, conscription, and invasion of privacy. Now, in what we're looking at Kitzisa, it's not explicitly commanded by God, but it certainly is implied, because he says, when you do it, you will have you'll have to pay this half a shekel, and they're nice enough to tell you that which shekel you should use, which standard, you know, the same way we would want to say you pay in American or pay in Canadian or pay in euros. So the census was to be taken. The payment was to be made in shekel hakodesh, and that shekel has 20 units, the gera. Now, this may help us date something. Late Babylonian coinage uses the gera, and there the gera is 1/24 of the shekel. But in any event, it's a standard here, and everybody pays the same. And notice it is called truma ladonai. You see. It's given. Everybody has to give it. This is verse. This is
you guys opened it last night.
What's
you
that?
It last night. Did anyone drink it?
What's that?
Carly, can you mute? Can Rizla. You mute, please?
Was there a question? I don't hear.
Nope, there was no question.
Oh, okay, no question. Okay, so I just wanted to point out that in verse 13, this a half a shekel is called truma l'Adonai. Now, don't confuse that in the from the truma, in Parashat Truma, in Exodus 25:1, and there materials are specified, but the amount isn't. You're just collecting material for the Mishkan, but the amount isn't specified. Now, if you want to see other censuses in the Bible, of course, in Bimidbar, chapter 1, there is an explicit command to do the numbering. I mean, this is why we call it the Book of Numbers. In fact, the classical name of it is Chomesh HaPikudim, that fifth of the Torah that has the Pikudim, which is the numbers. So there you take a look at in chapter 1, verse 2, and here again we get the same phrase Se'u et Rosh from Nasa Rosh to take the census. And every you count every male, and here you count heads or skulls. More in Exodus you counted heads or lift up heads. Here you count skulls, but here it's explicitly commanded, and there has to the and the thing that look at verse 4 here. So Moses and Aaron are commanded to take the census. But look what they have. The ish ish lamateh La Mate, Ish Rosh Levet Avotavu. So Aaron and Moses are to be accompanied, excuse me, by a representative from each tribe. Why do you think that is? What would be a good reason to have a representative from each tribe?
Well, you would get buy-in.
Well, you get buy-in, but what you also get is it keeps Moses and Aaron honest. When you have a rep from each tribe, they can't complain. Let's say if the numbers are challenged, if Moses and Aaron are challenged by the according to the numbers from the tribes, they say, "What do you mean? You had your representation there." So if you can't trust your own elders, I'm sorry. So that I think is what's behind it. And then if you go to Numbers 3:14 and following, Bimidbar 3:14 and following, there you have Moses counts the Levite males 1 month and older. It's interesting that Moses' command, when it comes to regular Israelites, they're 20 years and above. 20 years and above, but for the Levites, it's from the age of 1 month, okay? And then in chapter 3, verse 40, he counts the firstborn from 1 month and up. So you see here that the, it's positive. There's a positive part to the census. God commands it. And Moses does it. So that's the attitude here that the census is commanded by God. Now it gets a little dicey if we look at another place where you have a census, which at least in one version is commanded by God, but not in the but not for a good reason. Not for a good reason as far as the Israelites are concerned. If you will, please take a look at 2 Samuel 24. You don't have a full Tanakh in front of you, you got Machon Mamre on your smartphone. So you can follow me that way. So let me get to, please, this is 2 Samuel, Shmuel Bet, this is chapter 24. Okay. The reason I can't find it is I'm looking at Shmuel Aleph. Okay. Now look at the beginning of this. By Yosef af Adonai lacharot b'Yisrael. The anger of the Eternal flared up against Israel. And then it says, Vayased et David bahem lemor lech menei Yisrael vet Yehuda. Okay. So look at the beginning there. God continued to be angry, they translate here, flared up again, I like that, continued to be angry against Israel. So what did God do? God incited David to count the people. He incites David into a census. It may not look very nice that God incites it, but we'll take a look at that too. And by the way, this word here that's used to incite, vayaset, that's the same word that's used in Deuteronomy 13 when you are warned against having somebody incite you to worship other gods. So that's a rather nasty word. There's a noun for it in the rabbinic Hebrew, the mesit, the one who incites you to do the wrong things. And here God is the one who does it. Now look what happens after that. The king then calls calls Joab, who's his general, and he tells him, make the rounds of all the tribes of Israel, Midan Vad Beersheba, from Dan of Beersheba, take a census of the people so that I may know the size of the population. Okay? So look what Joab says. Joab answered the king, may the Lord your God increase the number of the people a hundredfold when your eyes see it. But why should my lord king want this? Okay. But the king refuses to back down, the way it says here, Vayechazak dvar ha-melech el Yoav el sarei ha-chayel. So David, being the king, is able to overrule them. So it's that. So they go out and do it, and it tells you they take this whole census here. Took nine months and 20 days, according to verse 8. Then Joab gave the number of the people to the king, and turns out that Israel was 800,000 soldiers ready to draw the sword, and the men of Judah numbered 500,000. Obviously, these numbers are fictional, but the point is that they get the whole count, and maybe even exaggerating the numbers has some point here. Anyway, look what happens in verse 10. Afterward, David reproached himself for having numbered the people. Literally, his heart hit him. So David then turns to the Eternal and says, I have sinned greatly. Now please remit the guilt of your servant. I've acted foolishly. So in response to that, the prophet Gad comes to David and says, God tells David, God tells Gad, I've got to get those vowels right. God tells Gad to go to David and say, thus says the Eternal, I'm giving you a choice here, choice of three punishments. Okay, you pick which one. So Gad comes to David and says, okay, what would you like? Here are your choices. 7 years of famine in your land, or next choice, three months of your being chased by your foes while they are persecuting you, pursuing you, or should there be three days of pestilence in your land? Tell me, and I'll get back to the one who sent me. I'll get back to God, G-O-D. So David says to Gad, I'm in great distress. Let us fall into the hands of the Lord, for his compassion is great. Let me not fall into the hands of men. Just as an aside here, rabbis, this in the Orthodox Tachanun, which is said every day that's not a holiday, or Shabbat, this is the verse that precedes it. There's a psalm after it, but this is the verse that precedes it. Anyway, so God listens to David's choice, and he sends a pestilence, and from Dan to Beersheba, 70,000 people died. And in fact, it says here, the angel, the mashchit, the angel that hits you, destroys you, angel of destruction, extended his hand against Jerusalem to destroy it. The Lord renounced further punishment and said to the angel who was destroying the people, enough, stay your hand, okay? So what do we have here? We have here complete opposition to the census. The idea is that a census is a terrible sin. You have David say, he says, Avon in verse 10, he says this is the sin. And this kalti mode, which means I'm really dumb. I was really dumb to do it. So this story is obviously a way of saying that a census is a bad thing. Now, so take a look though. So look at First Chronicles 21. Divrei Hayamim Aleph. Now look at this one here. This is the same story. As you all know, Divrei Hayamim retells a lot of the material in the books of Kings, and often puts its own spin on events in the book of Kings, often tells them quite differently from those events in the book of Kings. It's an early way of one writer commenting on the work of another. Anyway, but look at verse 21, verse 1. The Hebrew has, Vayamot Satan al Yisrael, Vayasad et David limnot et Yisrael. Satan rose against Israel and incited David to number Israel. You see? There's a tendency in the later books of the Bible to distance God from doing nasty things. Because anybody who reads, including the writer of this chapter in Chronicles, anybody who reads this is going to say, anybody who reads the account in 2 Samuel 24 is going to say, hey, that's a terrible thing. God commands you to do something and then punishes you for doing it. And that was the that was not something that troubled writers or thinkers in the pre-exilic period. But by the time of the exile and thereafter, they were troubled by it. And so Satan gets inserted into this material. Think of the Midrashim and on the Akedah, where the in the story in the Masoretic text, it's Elohim nisat Avraham. God on his own decided he's going to test Abraham and ask him to sacrifice his son. But if you read the Midrashim, Satan comes into it. Satan will come in and say, God, you know, just the other day in chapter 21, Abraham gave this big party. Did he even offer you anything? Did he offer a sacrifice or anything when he was celebrating his son's being weaned? Abraham doesn't even care about you. So it's at that point God says to Satan, well, you know, I will ask him to sacrifice his own son and he won't deny it. So there what you have is God is only testing Abraham because he wants to demonstrate to Satan the great faith of Abraham. But you see, there's that tendency in later material to try and remove God from doing nasty things, at least nasty things to Hebrews, Israelites, and Jews. He can do nasty things to Philistines and, of course, to Pharaoh. But it's not nice to do it to God's own people. Okay, any questions on anything so far? Okay.
The term to lift up the head is also used in the Joseph story when he's the dream of the baker, where there it means he's going to die.
Well, they use it three. Yeah, take a look at it. Actually, somebody a long time ago wrote an article. There are nice plays there. Very nice, shall we say, plays on words on that same idiom. You see the when you have there, and this is in chapter 41, in the dream there, the you have these dreams there, and the I'm sorry, 40 in chapter 40, the look at from verse 11 and following, the butler tells the dream to Joseph, and he says I've got this this vine there, etc., etc. And the goblet of Pharaoh is in my hand, and I took these the grapes and squeezed them in there. I gave it to Pharaoh, and Joseph says, "Well, the three branches there, the 3 days." Ba'od shlosha yamim yisa Pharaoh et roshcha. Okay, in 3 days. In this case, it means he will pardon you. He will pardon you. He'll lift up your hand. You know, like you see bad movies about the knights of old, and the king always puts his hand on the chin. So that's that Nasa Rosh. That's the meaning it's got here. And then the butler hears that this is the baker rather of 16 and following has had these he's heard that the dream is good. Well interpreted. So he says, I've seen in my dream, there were these 3 baskets, with big open work baskets, and it got all Pharaoh's food, all Pharaoh's baked goods, and birds were eating out of it on the top of my head. So Joseph says, here's its explanation. In 3 days, verse 19, he's going to immortalize you from the shoulders up. So there's literally nasa rosh, to lift your head up from off you. And finally, the third one, in verse 20, vayisa et rosh sar hamashkim bet rosh et sar haofim betoch avadav. Now here, they translate singled out. I would translate took account of. That is that Pharaoh is reviewing all his officials, and he now has to make some decision about what to do with or how to account for all his servants. But in any event, you have here three uses of Nasarosh in the same chapter, which is nice because this is one of the things that led for Harry to bringing this up, is that you have all these idioms in biblical Hebrew involving parts of the body, and they can have even the very same phrases can have very different senses. Okay. Now another thing that's
another question that came in.
Yeah.
Lauren is having trouble with her mic, so she asks if something changed in society that caused the later text to attempt to clean up God's reputation.
Well, what changes in society is a book like Divrei HaYamim is a product of the Persian period of Jewish history. That is the period from 539 BC to 330. During that period, the Persian Empire was the greatest empire in the world, and every Jew in the world lived under the Persian Empire. And and that naturally had influence on Jewish thinking. And one of the things that plays a big role here is, and the Persians were Zoroastrians. Persian rulers were Zoroastrians. And they believed that they a very dualistic system. There's the God, the creator God, Ahura Mazda, Lord Wisdom. He shows up in a slightly later form as Ormazd in the Talmud. He is the great creator God. He creates the universe. And it's all good. That's what, to put it in Hebrew, it's Tov Ma'od. It's all good. Now, how do we then account for the presence of evil in this world, which we've created all good? Well, according to Zoroastrian teaching, the good creation of Ahura Mazda was attacked by Angra Mainyu, the angry spirit. Again, he shows up in the Talmud as Ahriman, which is a later pronunciation. So he is responsible for everything that is good. So, for example, when you eat a fresh apple, it tastes great. But you leave it around for a while, what does Ahriman or Angra Mainyu do? He comes and makes it rotten. Okay? That's the way everything good is attributed to Ahura Mazda. And I think that rubbed off on the Jews, on the biblical writers. The fact is, as I mentioned in an earlier session, the Genesis 1 seems to be a Jewish adaptation of the notion that that the creation is good, because that is that story, Genesis 1, with its repetition of Tov Mod, it's the only place in the Bible where it's insistent that the creation is Tov and Tov Ma'od. Nowhere else in the Bible. Sometimes the creation is described as artful. Mara bugma secha Adonai, kulam b'chochma asita. How great are your works, O Lord? You did them all with chochma, wisdom. But that to say that the creation is good, that's not that's nowhere else in the Bible. And I think that tendency affects some of the rewriting, like the one we just saw in 1 Chronicles 21. This writer is definitely living in the Persian period. We don't have to guess about it. We got Persian words in here. Persian loan words are in here. So in Divrei HaYamim. So I think that's the cause for inserting Satan there. Okay. I like that question.
David,
yeah.
Is it possible that our parashat is a response to the Davidic position that we find in 2 Samuel that you can't take a census?
Yeah. One of the things that I have argued, I have this book here, came out with, where is it here? This book called the, here it is. This is the original Torah, it was called. And it came out in 1997. And basically what I argued there was that the Torah is political allegory. What do I mean by that? All the events in the Torah, they have a chronological setting from the creation of the world till the Hebrews are about to enter the promised land. Okay? Now, if we translate that into the Christian chronology that we all use, the chronological setting of the Torah is something like whenever the world was created to 1200 BC, something like that, okay? That's the chronological setting. But the fact is that most of the events in the Torah are actually reflections of stuff happening between around 1200 and 300 BC. Give a simple example. I didn't make this one up. If you look at Genesis 14, which is the war of the four kings against the five, and then you have at the end of the war, you have here that Abraham has a visit with Melchizedek, the king of Shalem, Shalem being the shorter form of Yerushalayim, and he takes a blessing to Abraham. Now, most people have argued here that Abraham's recognition of Shalem with its priesthood is an actual allegory of David, that Abraham here stands for David. David, as we all know, did what about Jerusalem? He made it his holy city, his capital city. So many, I think most scholars would say that Abraham here stands for, Abraham's seeing the sanctity of Jerusalem stands for David's sanctity of Jerusalem, okay? Abraham making deals over water rights with Philistines is again probably an attempt to justify David or Solomon making such deals with the Philistines. And this is the way I read the stories in the Torah. See, the Torah is not historical in any accepted sense of the word. First of all, as I say, the time setting here, the chronological setting, it reflects other stuff. When you read something here, it reflects other stuff. For example, here's another good one here. Let's go back to Kitisa, okay? So what's the bad news in Kitisa?
The golden calf built by
the
Jeroboam.
Golden calf, right? The golden calf here. The people saw how long Moses was taking to come down from the mountain. They turned to Aaron and say, "Make us Elohim to precede us, because this mortal Moses, we don't know what happened to him." So Aaron says, "Well, give me your gold jewelry, everybody's," and they do. He takes it and I follow my late lamented colleague Stanley Gavers here, taught in California for many years, that the Vayatzaratam Bacheret in verse 4 is he put them in a bag anyway, and from that he made an Egel Masecha, a molten calf, And obviously he's out of gold because that was the material I used for it. And he says, Ela Elohecha Yisrael, Asher Alucha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Okay? So that's so here's this setting here. The setting here in the time of the wilderness that the people somehow fashioned this golden calf. But the fact is, we have a realistic setting involving this. If you take a look at 1 Kings, Malachim Aleph, chapter 12, 25 and following. Okay, let's take a look at that. So we have here Malachim Aleph. And this is 12, 25 and following. See, this accounts for the split of the monarchy. Solomon dies, and his son Rehoboam is supposed to rule over Solomon had, but he made some diplomatic mistakes, and a rebellion broke out. Now we have to look. So let's look at 12, 25 and following. Okay. We have here, Jeroboam built up Shechem and Mount Ephraim, and then he fortified Penuel, okay? Fortified Penuel. And then he said to himself, the kingdom may well return to the house of David. If these people still go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, the heart of these people will turn back to their master, King Rehoboam of Judah. They will kill me and go back to King Rehoboam of Judah. Okay, so obviously this is an anti-Jeroboam story here. Okay, so the king took counsel and made two golden calves. He said to the people, "It is too far for you to go up to Jerusalem. This is your God, O Israel. These are your gods, O Israel." That brought you up from the land of Egypt. He set up one in Bethel and placed the other in Dan. That proved to be a cause of guilt. So the people went to worship the calf Bethel and one in Dan. He also made cult places appointed priests for the ranks of the people who are not Levite descent. So what does it tell you here? What does it tell you about Mr. Jeroboam, who is now setting up his own kingdom? First of all, it tells you he's a hypocrite. How is he a hypocrite? Because what's the motivation? That he has, according to the writer who has read his mind. What is he afraid of?
Rebellion.
Rebellion and his own death.
Right.
Right. He says, if the people continue to go to Jerusalem for their pilgrimages, that's the seed of the Davidids of David's grandson Rehoboam. So that going to that religious center also will serve a political purpose, but not my political purpose. It will serve the political purpose of Rehoboam of the Davidids. Okay, so we're told that this is what he was afraid of: rebellion. They'll rebel against me, and they'll kill me. But look what he says to the, what does he say to the people? He says to the people, I'm doing this for your own good. It's too far for you to go to Jerusalem. And by the way, he sets up the calves at the two boundaries, the northern and southern boundary of his kingdom. The northernmost being at Dan. I guess some of you have been at Tel Dan, in the northernmost part of the kingdom. And, Bethel was the southernmost part of the kingdom. Okay, so what it looks like to it looks like the story in the Torah of the golden calves attributed to the to Aaron and the rebellious people in the wilderness is actually a polemic against what Jeroboam did. And by the way, there's some very interesting things here. One of the things you have to realize is that, remember, the northern kingdom fell in 720 when the Assyrians conquered northern Israel. the southern kingdom, Judah, hung on till 586. Now, you know, we all know the story of the 10 lost tribes, and some probably were exiled to the east. But many of the exiles must have gone south. They fled south after the fall. That's why, for example, a prophet like Amos or a prophet like Hosea, who prophesied in the north, their books were transmitted in Judah. Okay, so material from the north came south. Now, because of the time lag between 720 and 586, the southern writers, the Judah writers, were able to put their own spin on some of the northern literature. And see, even here in this story, in 2 Kings, you can see some of the original, the positive picture of what Jeroboam did. You see, look, what's the, take a look at, what's the first verse? In verse 25, what did he do? What did Jeroboam do? After he built up Shechem, what did he do? What else did he build up?
He fortified a bunch of different cities.
Yeah, well, what's the one that's mentioned here at the end of verse 25?
Penuel.
Yeah, so we're...
That's where Jacob wrestles.
That's where Jacob wrestles. Look at Genesis 33, 25 and following. So Genesis 33, almost there, Dave. Okay, so he has this fight with the. Thirty-two, twenty-five. Jake was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till the dawn rose. And when the man saw that he couldn't beat Jacob, he threw a dirty punch, and Jacob's hip was wrenched at the socket. Okay. In any event. So that's his fighting with the angel, and the angel blesses him, and the angel won't tell him his name. The verse 31, Vayikra Yaakov Shem Hamakom Pani El Kiraiti Elohim Panim El Panim. So Jacob's renaming by the angel is at a place which he names Pani El. It's a holy site. Why is it a holy site? Obviously, that's where Jacob got blessed by the angel, where he saw the angel. Okay, so and by the way, how's the chapter end? He winds up at Shechem, and then we have something else here. Where else did he set up the calf? Verse 29. Where did Jeroboam send up the calf? What's the name of the place?
Beit El,
right? Beit El. Well, again, what's the positive story about Beit El?
Jacob has his dream there with the ladder.
They had the dream with the ladder, and look the way it concludes there. It says, first of all, he put up a stone there, which he... And poured oil on top of it. He called the place Beit El, Beth El, the house of God. His name was Luz, but he renamed it. And look what he says in verse 20. But Yidar Yaakov Neder Lemor, Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and protect me on this journey, which I am going, and give me food to eat and clothing to wear, and I return home to my father's house, then Yod Hey Vav Hey, the Eternal will be me a God for me. And Ha'Even Hazot, Asher Samti Matzevah, the stone that I set up now as a pillar, that shall be Beit Elohim. That shall be Beit Elohim, and everything you give me, I will tithe. So there was a foundation story, if you will. How come this place got called Bethel, and how come a temple was built there? Because one could easily, I don't think it's any kind of a stretch to say that Jeroboam and the people who were pro-Jeroboam, told this story about, we're building this temple here. Why? This is the temple was where Jacob had his vision of the angels going up and down. So it's a holy site, you see? So what you have here what I would call a northern story, which regardless of when it was written, I think it's a pretty early story, but regardless of when it was written, that's the good news about the founding. That's about the founding of Bethel. And the same thing with Jeroboam associated with Phanuel, which is associated with Jacob. Then what happens is when the southerners get their hand on it, they distort the whole story. They see this building of a temple putting up these calves and these sanctuaries, one at Bethel and one at Dan. They describe it as a chatat. That is not. This is a sinful. This is, if you want to borrow a Christian term, the original sin of the Northern Kingdom. And you know, when you read the books of Malachim, when the writer wants to praise a good northern king, he qualifies it by saying, well, the only thing he did wrong was he followed in the footsteps of Jeroboam, the son of Nevat, Asher Chata Bechti et Yisrael, who sinned himself and brought Israel to sin. That's the refrain that runs through every case in the, even when the writer of Kings has something nice to say about a northern king, he has to qualify by saying, no, he still followed in the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nevat, who sinned and did everything for it against Israel. I want to point out something else here that I kind of find it amusing. Look at we're back in 1 Kings 12. In addition, at the end of it, it says that it was a sin, and then guess what? 31 to 32. Bayas et Beit Bamot. He made an enclosure of a bama. We don't know exactly what bama is. They usually translate high place. If we found one with a name Baman, that would be good. The ideal archaeological situation where the thing is named. Don't have it yet. So he made a Bama, and he appointed priests from the corners of the people, these people were not from B'nai Levi. They were not Levites. And then he set up another festival. Now, it's almost absurd. What's the writer say? The writer wants you to get the impression that the religion practiced, if you want to, in the Northern Kingdom was idolatrous. That they're actually sacrificing to these calves. Okay, that's what the impression you're supposed to get. Now, but he then adds another accusation. What's wrong? That he didn't use Levite priests. Now, suppose he'd used Levite priests in idolatrous worship. Would that make it better? Now, you know, it would be like a couple of super Orthodox people saying something like, You know, the Reformed Temple in our town, not only do they have an organ, but their rabbi doesn't have an Orthodox smicha. I mean, would it be better? Would it be better from in an Orthodox value system if the temple had an organ and had somebody who was an Orthodox musmach? But that's the what he's doing here is caricaturing the whole worship set up by Jeroboam. And in fact, there is nothing inherently sinful about having bovines. You see, take a look at 1 Kings 7:29. This is Solomon's temple. Okay? Take a look at this. 1 Kings. This is the account of Solomon building the temple. 1 Kings 7. Above the frames was a stand, and both above it and below the lions and oxen were spirals of hammered metal. Each laver stand had four bronze wheels, two bronze axle trees. Its four legs had brackets, the lip brackets, etc., etc. So you have here a picture of these different animals. On verse 29, on the insets within the frames were lions, oxen, and cherubim. Cherubim, we know that's an Akkadian loan word. It's some kind of a hybrid creature that was used to, not a real creature, sculptures that were used to guard temples and palaces. But see, you've got these bovines here. So there's let me leave you with the following thought. Religious rites and institutions are often, perhaps usually, not evaluated on their own. The merits or demerits of a rite, an institution, an object, how do I phrase it here, depends on the performer, the group with whom the performer is associated, and the author of the text providing the description, and finally the audience to whom it is directed. Okay, so since Jeroboam, according to the southern writers, he was the original sinner, so he can't do anything right. Even if it's a lot illogical, he can't do anything right. So even though there is no prohibition against bovine type creatures, if it's associated with Jeroboam, it's bad. So I leave you just by thinking that. Remembering that what we have in our Bible is ideological literature. They're not out, for the most part, to give us objective, dispassionate descriptions. They're making points. Okay, any questions?
David, I have a question.
Please.
So the bulls resemble Canaanite worship with the Baal riding on the back of the bull. And we're told that the temple was built with the help of the Phoenicians.
Sure.
Was this just two different architecture styles, with one with God out in front on top of the bull, and one with God on the inside the holiest of holies?
There'd be different ways of doing it. By the way, we do have I hope it's still standing. A few years back, they discovered a temple about 40 miles from Aleppo in Syria. At a place called Ain Dara. You can Google it, A-I-N-D-A-R-A. And according to various archaeologists, it matches very closely with the description, the dimensions, and features of the Jerusalem temple in 1 Kings 7. And you would expect that. You know, there's going to be styles get copied. But of course, there will be variations. If we had more temples, we'd be able to have more variations.
Is this intransigency that we see, the fact that they're doing political points, a difference between the fact that we are monotheistic? Because you don't see exactly the same thing if you had multiple gods and you could worship them this antagonism wouldn't exist.
What's that? I'm sorry. I missed the last part.
Okay. What I'm simply saying is if you had a polytheistic society, having one more type of worship or one more type of God wouldn't be a problem. But you're saying all of this is political. So is this one of the ramifications of being monotheistic?
No, not necessarily. It's, no, I don't see that there's a necessary connection. It's just that there, within a monotheistic society, not exactly when Israel became monotheistic is another problem. But even within a monotheistic society, there's still going to be disputes over certain issues. I tell you a good story. My wife, Rabbi Jennifer Jake, was a child when she grew up. She was born into a family of Missouri Synod Lutherans out in Richland, Washington, okay? And we started going out about 17 years ago. I asked her, what it was like in the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church that she went to. What did the pastor say about the Jews? She said he never talked about the Jews. If you made a 30-mile circle around Richland, Washington, maybe get 80 Jews, okay? So the Jews were not on the radar. But every week, she says, when she was a child, Pastor Kellerman, every Sunday, would be railing against the Catholic idolaters because, they have all these images, these statues. And this is, within the ecclesia, within the Christian church here, there are lots of, there's a lot of room for debate. So it's not a question even of even of monotheism versus polytheism. It's a question of even within monotheism, there are all kinds of issues. And by the way, infighting within the same religion is often sharper than between religions. I mean, Sunni Shia, 2 centuries ago, Hasidim Esnagdim. So so even within the people who supposedly share the same religion and basic religious beliefs will kill each other, literally, kill each other over variations of that. So that's the way I would see it.
Thanks. I was simply actually agreeing with you because what I was thinking is in a polytheistic society, this tension would be less than within a monotheistic one.
It's going to depend on a bunch of different things. We don't know all the variables. It's for ancient Israel. We have, basically the Bible is our biggest source of information. We don't have, for example, like temple lists, offering lists. We have in the Bible, we don't have independent lists of temples, independent lists of cultic personnel. So we have to do a lot of speculation.
Thanks.
Sure. Thank you.
And with that, I think we were at time. Dr. Sperling, thank you so much for leading us in this week's Parashat HaShavuah. Thank you to our alumni. Thank you to everybody for joining us and for helping to create such a robust session. Thank you for adding your thoughts and your questions. This was incredibly enjoyable. So thank you all. And as a reminder, our next Parashat HaShavuah session will take place on April 3rd. You have a few weeks, and then we'll meet back again together. And if you have any questions, as always, you can email me at alumni@huc.edu. And please do check the website. We've had a little bit of a glitch, but we're working on getting all of our videos and recordings from this past semester up. So I do encourage you to go in, take a look at some of the sessions that are coming up, some of the sessions that have already happened. huc.edu/alumni learn. And with that, we're closing today's session. Thank you all so much. Have a wonderful day.
Bye-bye.